Marty Noxon, welcome to the program.
Why, thank you.
So you are running three shows on three different networks, right? So my first question is, do you actually have time to be sitting here doing this interview?
No, I sent my doppelganger. This is my interview persona.
How do you do it? I mean, just in a logistical sense to get us started.
Well, right? I mean, that's what's interesting is a lot of people think that it's an actual – that you're doing all three at the same time.
Yeah.
But the reality of television is like, Girlfriend's Guide, which is just aired its last episode.
Right.
We wrapped that over a year ago.
Oh.
They're just
dropping
it. See, now
there's the illusion just
right? They're dropping
shot
it
all day.
Right now. And, the trickier one was Sharp Objects and Dietland because they really did overlap.
Right.
The fact of the matter is I think one of the weird things about being a showrunner or a show creator is that people think that you do it all yourself. And there's sort of this myth of, well, I'm the auteur of this project, so I literally just – I run from one thing to another.
Yeah.
But the truth is, I have so many wonderful people that I work with. And one of the ways that I really believe a show gets great is by letting people do their jobs, by learning to let go of certain things and be like, you're great at that. You don't have to ask me every question. Like, you can answer your own question. How about that?
How hard was it for you to let go?
It depends on the show. Like,
that's so funny.
A little bit. Or maybe it depends on the what phase the show is in.
Uh-huh.
When we're first creating it and sort of setting the template for how it looks and how it feels, I'm very hands-on. And but there's a lot of ways to communicate that aren't just me talking all the time. Like, you can create, for Dietland, we created a lookbook and I created like a visual map of how different parts of the show should look. And even as specific as our camera movement changes from the first episode to the last very purposefully. We go from a really static point of view to a much more dynamic point of view. And that was on purpose. But I could communicate that through kind of a Bible. And then other people could share that information. Like, this is the color palette here. This is, I'm pretty controlling at the beginning.
I was just going to say, well, I was with you until you got the color palette. And I'm like, oh, man, wait, what?
No, I mean, it's very intentional. It's very intentional, every part of it. I mean, because television is so much more like film now.
Yeah.
And, the level of quality that you want to try to achieve and the visual quality, unless you're just communicating like a crazy person, it can drift.
You mentioned television and film, and I didn't want to ask the peak TV question, but there, right? Because everybody asks it.
Every
TV person I get in here, I ask a peak TV question, and then it inevitably gets cut in the edit, right? So I'm not going to ask it, but I'm going to ask a version of it, which is, TV now is, and this is not my original idea, it's the American art form now.
Right.
It's the American visual art form.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I made a film called To the Bone, which, we took to Netflix, and it was the first thing I've directed in a long time. And, we took it to Sundance, and it's a movie, but the major player that stepped forward was Netflix. And it was so interesting because everybody else sort of dropped away because they knew they couldn't match that deal. Netflix put, $8 million on the table for a film that cost around $3 million. And by the way, at that point, I don't have a choice. Like, I've given the choice of where it goes over to the producers
who found
the money.
Yeah.
So they just sort of said, we're going with Netflix, even though part of me was like, but I want it to be a movie. I want it to be a movie in theaters. And that said, now people think it's a movie that was made for TV, when it wasn't. But the upside of that is, I don't know how many millions of people have seen this film.
Yeah, totally.
And Netflix told us that it's been one of the most successful films they've had. So it is weird that the business model is just changing it. So even if you very intentionally make a film, it's going to end up being on TV.
So we're getting far afield from my notes and the stuff I want to talk to you about. But I think this is really interesting because, I mean, do you look now at the dollar figures being thrown around?
Yeah.
Content dollar figures with Netflix and HBO and Amazon. And do you just go, holy cow, this is amazing?
Well, you know, I think I've come to a much broader understanding of the business. I used to be like, I'm not interested in the business. I'm just a writer.
No, neither,
I'm just a writer, right? You know, I'm just a writer. I'm just a writer and director. I don't want to know. But, you know, you have to learn about the business. And the truth is, their business model for that $8 million, they got a piece of content that potentially can up the profile of the brand and live on for for 15 people are still emailing me that they just saw the movie.
Yep.
And Girlfriend's Guide, for instance, I think is much better business for Netflix than it ever was for NBC that made it. So when you think about, like, let's look at the finances for something like Sharp Objects, which, you know, was a movie budget, you know, a big movie budget, but they got 8 hours of content for less than they would have paid maybe for a movie, or the same amount. They get 8 hours that
goes
all around.
Which will air forever.
Which will air forever, and they control it. So the more I started to understand that, the more I started realizing, like, a lot of this money that they end up paying to the writers or the actors is insignificant to them, based on the content that plays internationally for years and years and years. So it's a really interesting, like, I used to definitely be, you know, lie awake at night thinking it's not fair. Like, a teacher makes, you know, nothing. And I you know, and they work so much harder than I do sometimes. Yeah. But then I'd also understand, like, what I am creating something that has this value in some cases, just sort of in perpetuity. So shouldn't we get, you know, a share of that, you know, and then that leads to a whole other rabbit hole of, like, what do you do with that money? You know,
well, right. That's
thing. Another podcast.
So that's right. So let me pull back out of that rabbit hole then and get to some of the stuff I want to talk about on the list, which is the content of the stuff that is on your show, specifically now Dietland and Sharp Objects.
Yeah.
It's not autobiographical, right? But there's a lot of you in here. You draw on you in the themes and the emotional impact of a lot of what's in here.
Yeah.
Is that easy? Why? First of all, why?
Why? You know, let's get my shrink on the phone. I'm working on a film right now, a story about a woman who a true story based on a true story about a woman who has become incredibly active in, you know, the fight for gun safety laws.
Yeah.
And what started her on that path was that, you know, she lost her son in a Stand Your Ground shooting. And people keep asking me, like, that's not funny. Like, why, you know, and you're funny and you're light, you know, why do you keep going to these stories? But the truth is, you know, for me, the way that I can connect with people emotionally is to dig into something really personal and try to reveal something about my own life experience or fears or concerns that other people will suddenly feel less alone. They'll be able to say, oh, you know, this woman who lost her child, I made all these assumptions about him, you know, but she was a Delta flight attendant for 30 years, you know, and their kids were great and they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, you know, and we make all these assumptions about other people. And for me, you know, gun safety is one of those issues that it feels like if we don't do something about it, you know, we're going to be in worry. It's one of those issues that impacts so many things we don't even think about. So, why? It's because I really believe that I was put on this earth to, like, try to create more empathy.
Well, and well, I get that, which leads to this, and we need to be clear here. You are a survivor of sexual assault, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You have fought alcoholism and beaten it, right? Your characters that you write now are women who are dark and interesting in a way that women haven't always been allowed to be on television.
Yeah.
So when you look at people looking at your work, as personal as it is, is it hard for you?
You know, I think it's harder for me than I think it is. You know, I think that I, you know, I was just joking on the way in that I'm having this sort of, like, my low-level depression, you know, right now, that both shows are airing, you know,
right.
And people
you've done the hard work and now
I've done all this hard, and now I'm already back in the room for season two of Dietland, you know, But I'm having this sense of real, like, letdown because I think I have this fantasy that I'll share the stuff that's so personal. I was joking. And then I'll just be invited to, like, the eternal birthday party, you know, where all my friends are. And we just get to, like, play and, you know, and I'm still waiting for my invitation to the, you know, to the everlasting birthday party that you never have to come down from. You know, I think it is harder for me than I like to admit. And I'm definitely, like, maybe I should do just a straight up comedy.
I'm not actually sure what that would look like for Marty Noxon, to be honest with you.
Yeah, because I thought that Dial Line was pretty funny, actually. And it has funny moments.
It's so dark. I know that sounds terrible, but it's really dark in what for a lot of people in this country are dark times.
Yes.
Do you worry about that?
Well, I mean, but look at. Yeah. Yes, I do. In the sense that right now my appetite is for like reality shows about making homes nicer. Mm-hmm, now I'm having a hard time going to the dark place.
Would you watch your shows? Right.
I would totally watch.
Would you? Okay.
Because here's my feeling: like Plum, especially in Dietland,
and
Camille in Sharp Objects. These are women who are facing these hard things and moving forward anyway. You know, their strength is really inspiring to me, and the fact that, you know, like Camille clearly is in the midst of a horrible bout of alcoholism, but she is determined to find the truth. And Plum has had a lifetime of one way of thinking, but her world is turned upside down. And then she keeps finding like joy. She keeps finding joy in the world and in herself. And to me, like, that's what we all have to deal with is, you know, I have these feelings that want to keep me in bed. How do we keep feeling connected to each other and moving forward? So I feel like the response to both shows has been really passionate. And the people who found Dietland, I get these text messages that are like, this is life. Like, this is keeping me feeling like I'm not alone, you know. So I feel like I would watch, especially because it feels like new. I also get bored. Part of the reason I stop watching TV sometimes is like I've been doing this for 20 something years, and I play that game of like, and now this is going to happen.
Yeah.
And I love shows where I'm like, I don't know what's going to happen, you know. And I do think we delivered on that on both.
It's worth pointing out here. You come from, you did Grey's Anatomy, and part of the reason you left Grey's Anatomy, there was a great line you gave in some interview. Oh, I guess they're going to have sex now. Let's move on. Right?
And then they put their hands in someone's brain. And no disrespect to that, but I get that ritual kind of television that has a kind of almost kabuki aspect to it, where you just play out the same thing over and over again, and the results are often good. Yeah. That doesn't feel like life to me. You know, it feels a little bit like a beautiful lie. So I'm not that motivated by that. You know, unfortunately, some people would say because I could be on a yacht right now. I wouldn't know what to do on a yacht. I'd be so bored.
I could do it for like a week or two.
Yeah. But then I'd start, you know, making all the people who work on the boat, like, tell me their stories and acting them out. And
Can when you watch not Marty Noxon television, can you detach? Or are you always watching with an eye, as it were?
You know, one of my favorite shows of the last couple of years was definitely Handmaids, because
of course it was given the kind of television you make, but
I was
surprised. I can't watch that because I don't need more dystopia in my life.
Well, the first, you know, I'm talking about the first season. I haven't watched the second, and I was very reluctant because I was like, I read the book, and I'm scared all the time, so no thank you. But I love that show so much because of Elizabeth Moss's character, and also I had this sort of sly, she had a sly sense of humor in the first season, like that you felt her wickedness, like her will to live, but also like the visual control of how it looked and how, you know, how sumptuous it was. I fell into it, like I wasn't thinking that much after a while, and I love Atlanta and Insecure and you know, shows from new sources, those things get me really excited. Yeah.
Could you have made the shows you're making, the kind of content you're making, like 10 years ago? And had it been received as it is being received?
I mean, no question I couldn't have. Right. You know, when we were out there pitching Girlfriend's Guide, which, you know, the premise seems so gentle now, but it was literally about, this was, you know, 6-7 years ago, about, you know, to pitch it before it actually got made. The premise was that women are starting to have as much economic power in a lot of relationships. And so that changes the dynamic between men and women so radically, and we don't have a handbook for that. So how do we explore that with women of a certain age who, you know, the joke was always like on Sex and the City, those women didn't seem to have a lot of real life problems.
You know? Yeah.
Like they had sex problems, but somehow like every once in a while, Carrie would be like, oh, I want to buy the apartment next to me.
I have to write more articles.
You know, it didn't seem, and I was so interested in revisiting, you know, sexual politics with women who had all the complications of children and lives,
right.
But also
and big jobs
and
right?
big jobs yeah. and ex-husbands or jobs that failed and now you don't have enough money to pay for your overly beautiful house and your heels and stuff. But also the premise was that they find divorce very liberating, that not being in a relationship is actually, you know, throws everything up in the air, and then they sort of reinvent themselves. And that was literally, I'd have male executives say, I don't think I'd want my wife to watch this.
Wow.
Like, that's really scary.
Wow. So on the theory that at least part of what good television does is reflect society back to itself, right?
Yeah.
With society moving so fast in so many ways these days, do you worry you're behind by the time you get the pitch process and the pilot and people vote and then you get on the air? You're worried you fall behind, right?
That's one of the reasons I think YouTube is so fascinating, and the fact that my 13-year-old and 16-year-old watch so much content on YouTube because it's kind of in real time.
Yeah.
So the people that they love can be responding to stuff so quickly and sort of riding that wave of current events. Although a lot of the stuff, frankly, that they watch has nothing to do with current events. It is pure escapism. It's like, you know, makeup, you know, how to look like, you know, how to turn yourself into a unicorn.
right.
But, you know, you can't worry about that. And with Dietland, you know, we were scouting when the Harvey Weinstein stuff broke and then Me Too and Time's Up. And we, you know, some people were like, I wonder if the show will still be relevant. And I was like, I think this isn't going to get resolved, you know. I think we're okay.
And oh, look, you were right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So with these shows and you doing what you're doing for really difficult female characters.
Yeah.
What does it look like in like 10 or 15 years if this keeps going the way you're going with it?
Well, I mean, do you mean for me personally
for the industry too,
yeah.
right? I mean, because it can't just be Marty Knox and doing these characters and it won't be.
I mean, and it already isn't. Like that's what's so exciting is that that, you know, once a barrier is broken and you can prove an economic upside for the industry, it's all about the Benjamins. It's all about money, you know. And I have no illusions about that. The very same people who were afraid to touch Girlfriend's Guide 7 years ago have said, "Do you have anything else on divorce?"
That's great. How great is that?
Right? Like, what
Karma,
else could you do on divorce? And you're well, I'm kind of tapped out on divorce. You know, my divorce story right now is eating lentil chips in bed alone. You know, it's not a great show.
but I've got these other things about self-harm and alcoholism and
obesity and the fact that, you know, for me, you know, what's been so incredible is that the people who respond the most intensely to Dietland are people who've never felt okay in their bodies. And that includes people of all genders and all races. And the fact that we're just unapologetically saying, here's this hero character who's not going to change for you. And she's not going to, you know, there's no hero's journey where she gets socially acceptable in a way that we used to think of it, you know? That's a really powerful thing. And I feel like, yeah, once you break some of those barriers down and you say, this is a different kind of character. She's not locked in self-loathing. Now she's trying to figure out what she does next, you know? But then you suddenly see people going like, well, maybe we'll do that superhero woman, you know, who's not a size 3. Right. And so that's one of the things is you feel like you're sort of forging new ground. And then all these other people are allowed to tell those stories. So and it's all about the money. If we can make money doing it, then other people can do it, too. I mean, Black Panther's going to change, you know, is changing things for movies forever, you know.
Marty Knoxon, it's a couple of shows, Sharp Objects and Dietland, also Girlfriend's Guide. Thanks for coming in. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.